Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Ensure your next purchase is the real deal and shop authentic handbags, watches, sneakers, streetwear, and jewelry from eBay, backed by Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Vanity Fair.
Let me introduce my twins. Spinach, because of that American Pop Pie cartoon. And then broccoli just come naturally. Strength and health.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss HBO's The Sympathizer. Well, the first three episodes, I should say.
Yes, only the first three.
No. A death wish. A death wish. Does that mean anything to you?
And later, the star of the show, Hua Shande, who plays the captain, will be here in the studio to tell us about landing the role and the many faces of Robert Downey Jr.
So we're three episodes into the show, and I'm just going to do a quick recap of what's happened so far. We meet the captain, a spy for the Viet Cong infiltrating the South Vietnamese military and the Americans.
Guess we all look the same after all, right? I mean, I could be Viet Cong, for all you know. Undercover. How would you know?
After the dramatic fall of Saigon, the captain is sent to the U.S. to keep a close eye on the general. But as they set up their new lives in L.A., the general becomes convinced that a spy is in their midst.
I mean the spy.
Oh. I've been thinking about it, General, and maybe there is no spy after all.
What are you talking about? Of course there is.
In the third episode, the captain plots and murders the major and is able to pin suspicions of there being a mole on him.
Well, remember at the liquor store, we told you someone pegged you for a spy? Guess who? What a fool. He pegged the guy we trust most. Welcome to the world of spycraft.
The captain stays in the favor of the CIA and is given a new assignment. He's going to consult on a film about Vietnam. And we meet Robert Downey Jr. playing four characters at the same time.
Cool you just, kid. There's no apology coming. But I am going to give you the opportunity of your fucking life.
I don't take an opportunity over an apology 8 days a week.
Doesn't sound like such a bad deal. Looks like we just sealed the deal there.
So I have to be honest, it took me a little bit of time to get into the show. I think it's deliberately set up narratively to be a little confusing. I mean, it's an espionage story. It's about double allegiances, things like that.
There's a whole frame narrative.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The framing narrative. But Park Chan-wook, the director of the first episode, is a cerebral guy, but he's also a visceral filmmaker. Mm. And so by the end of this first episode, or the first episode where we have the plane scene, I was like, okay, now I'm really paying attention. And that really sets you up for the next two episodes because you're really invested in the world all of a sudden. And I hate to say that, like, a violent action scene is what did it for me, but hey, look, I'm American.
Yeah.
Well, because, yeah, I think the fall of Saigon is also, like, kind of what sealed it for me, because that is something I think that has been depicted many times in culture. Very rarely, at least in, you know, Western culture, Americans, more specifically, from a Vietnamese perspective.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that was, something that I have, an event that I've heard referenced a million times. You know, I saw Miss Saigon or whatever, but, like, I have never seen it like this and really kind of understood just the weight of it and the violence and just, how upsetting it is to be, like, thrust into that. I think really kind of helps the show make its case from a very early point.
Yeah, and to consider, again, which sounds so American and jingoist, but to consider the other side and to sort of see these, you know, Vietnamese people and soldiers living their life, drinking beer, just hanging out in the town square days before the city completely falls. And having that mundane sort of day-to-day aspect of it and then watch it crash and crumble in what felt like seconds, and a really huge set piece with the bombs exploding and running to the aircraft that's really where it grabbed me. Because I won't lie, I was like a little confused a little bit at the beginning with the double allegiances. He's a spy. He's watching a woman get tortured.
And he's watching the interrogation in a movie theater, so it's like layers on layers.
It's layers on layers, and we're sort of dropped in. We're plopped in the middle, and then even more so, as we said, the framing device where he's then captured and telling the story about his time as a spy. It was a little hard to place myself at the beginning, but once we got to that big set piece, it was like, whoa.
And I kind of wonder if there's something meta-contextual about it. Like, it's my understanding that the book that the show is based on was in part written because there is so little in the English language that considers the Vietnamese perspective on this whole conflict. And the show being confusing to me, an American audience member, because I can't figure out who's on what side and what's going on. It's like, right, because I don't know enough about the internal politics of South Vietnam and North Vietnam and the Viet Cong versus the other side, you know. And so I think the show, in a way, is making a point where it's like, yes, does this look like a confusing morass of ambivalence and ambiguity? Well, maybe Americans shouldn't have gone blundering into that,
Because there are so many forces at play. There's North Vietnam and South Vietnam and the colonial French influence
and the Americans.
And, you know, the communist influence from, like, the Soviet Union. Like, there's all of these things happening in one place at the same time. And, it's a big mess. And it's reductive to just call it a big mess. Like, this show doesn't just do that. It does kind of tease out the various parties at play and the ways in which our title character, the unnamed captain, kind of is like a synthesis of all of them he's trying to
split between all of these different things, being half French, half Vietnamese. He's spent time in America, but he's back in Vietnam, and he's a sympathizer. He's a communist, but he's pretending to be on the American side. It is really sort of fascinating how the captain is sort of bifurcated and split between all of these different sort of competing identities and competing factions and navigates them. And that is, I mean, Hua's performance is so interesting and really compelling because he does a really great job of bouncing between all of these different aspects of his identity while still being like one complete real person. He doesn't feel like a caricature of a spy or...
And I will say that I read the book before I watched the show, and that does make things
very good.
Easier to follow, but I don't know. There's a way in which, like, I think what you were just saying about Park Chan-wook, Richard, about his ability to kind of balance the cerebral stuff with the visceral stuff, I think that there's a way in which that makes the show more effective in some ways, because the book is, you know, it is written as a confession, and obviously not a confession that anybody actually could have written because it's so detailed.
Yeah.
But that is the device. And I think that when you read it, it's beautiful and it's complicated, but it also is very wordy and, like, does get kind of bogged down sometimes in the bigger ideas. And I think that being able to see the action play out the way that it does on the screen kind of frees the story from some of the constraints that it's put under in the novel. So I don't know. There are ways in which I think that the show actually does a better job of telling the story.
Well, that's interesting. So I was right to not read the book. Good.
You don't trust the Pulitzer Prizes.
Yeah. Right. Never have, never will.
I mean, you know, in relation to the captain, our lead character, I mean, it is fascinating and sad. Like, look how many different, you know, skills and sort of connections he needs to have just to kind of survive this situation. He seems very adept at it, which is why I'm curious about what the framing device, because it seems to me that he is a master spy and that the Viet Cong would be thrilled with his work.
Yeah, so how is he going to get caught?
Yeah, why is he now in trouble? I'm assuming that will come from when we travel to America, and, you know.
Well, it's interesting. I think we've been talking a lot about the first episode. There's so much work. If you think about it, the first episode has to do, I mean, every pilot is, you know, it's a big undertaking. You have to set the scene, but laying out the conflict and every, you know, all parts of, you know, the Viet Cong, the Americans, the French, the spy of it all, it's a lot, and it was a lot to digest. But once we got to episode two and episode three, and we sort of settled in America and we really got to know the general and his, the captain's relationship with Bon and leaving Man behind, that's when things really, again, settled in a way that I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying the show. I'm really interested in the interpersonal dynamics. And now the weight of the history isn't overwhelming or feeling distracted.
It's maybe helpful for the narrative that the show or that the war and kind of the conflict, the main conflict is
done. In the past, yes. It's in the past, and then we get to...
But what I find fascinating about that is, and I'm not... This is not necessarily an original idea, because I did read a couple of reviews of the book, that, like, I don't know if either of you have read any Graham Greene, but, like, he's this great spy... was this great spy novelist who would tell these stories that felt really quotidian and small and petty, and you were like, why, how is this like an espionage thriller? But then gradually it builds and you understand that this local thing happening actually has really broad implications for something multinational. And I feel like that's kind of some what's being set up here, where it's like, okay, so the general is sort of pathetic, like he's still sort of clinging to some sort of idea, but they're in America, they're far away from anywhere that they could actually have an effect. But I don't know. It seems that like we might be building toward that kind of thing where it's like this small thing actually is operating in some ways as the as a microcosm of a bigger thing. So I'm curious to see how that unfolds, because I don't necessarily know that the captain, at least as he's kind of written and played, like I don't. It doesn't seem like he's going to stay 100% loyal to anything. So I'm curious to see where that shakes out. I wanted to pivot and ask you guys about you thought about the Robert Downey Jr. of it all. He's hot off an Oscar.
Yeah.
He's playing more than one role here. Does he... At first, I thought he sort of stuck out where it was like a little too actory and movie starry, but maybe that is kind of the point?
I think that some of the voices he's using for some of the characters are making me do a double take. I guess I'm talking specifically about the professor.
That's the one
where, I mean, I don't know if I can say this, but coming from the straight community, I'm listening to him and I'm like, I mean, I guess like this is a guy who is putting on like his entire life is a performance.
Yeah.
And I guess that that's sort of true for all of like the different men that Downey is playing. You know, he has, you know, this like Reagan-esque congressman. He has this like hotshot director who's clearly Francis Ford Coppola, and he has the professor, and then he has Claude, who is sort of understated. He's still kind of doing a voice.
Yeah, he definitely.
But it has this like ridiculous hair. It feels maybe a little SNL when he pops up in different guises. Although, I mean, in your review, Richard, I think you got at why they did it this way, is that, you know, he is playing all of these men because they represent the different ways in which, you know, the white men who are kind of in control of everything are in control of everything.
Yeah. It's
and the way in which they blend together.
Kind of aggregate colonialist man.
And I think it's also interesting, the idea of the captain is split between two sides and is doing these multiple identities, and having Robert Downey Jr. actually having multiple identities, all of which are nefarious and want something insidious and from the captain. And
they're all trying to exploit him in different ways.
They're all trying to exploit him in different ways. And they all look somewhat different, but they ultimately, they're all the same. I think it works on like a thematic level and a meta level. And Robert Downey Jr., and it's one of those things where like with the voice and the professor voice, I was like, if he were worse, then I would be like, that is bad. But I really do buy, I think it's a hard, tricky tonal thing, because obviously this is grave subject matter, but you have to have some light, some fun, something that isn't just so dire about the fallout of the war, I think, to keep people from, you know, being like, oh, this is a drag, and turning it off. And I think Robert Downey Jr., with his sort of zany way about him, his approach to these characters.
Zany is a good word for his energy.
It's very, it's zany and it's compelling. And so far I'm here for it, but I am a little bit of a let actors act type of a
I can agree with that. And I think also in a story like this, it is very easy and lazy to just have, like, all the white people are evil, yeah. And, like, this is not that. There is more going on to it.
It's more complicated because also the captain needs something from all of these people in his own way. I mean, the professor got him to America, helped him get his education. Claude helps him get out of Vietnam. I mean, sort of lies, but is part of that. And, you know, the director, that's going to be, I think, a really interesting episode where we get to, whenever we get to see this movie that he's going to serve as a consultant on, the captain. There's an exchange, right, between the captain and these white men, and whether or not that is fair and how that actually affects the captain, I think it'll be interesting to see. Like, how much do you sacrifice to get ahead or to exist in this new world that he's in.
And who's using who.
And who's using who more, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that setting up these comical but also sinister relations with America, as exemplified by Robert Downey Jr., the show has a really interesting tone where I'm not quite sure, is this comical? Is it suspenseful? Is it both? Is this satire? Is it kind of almost like a warning to, you know, about like future U.S. adventurism abroad? You know, I think it maybe is all those things, which is a lot to contain on television. But I don't know. I think that they add enough selling points, action sequences, big movie star, that hopefully people will stick with it. And I officially give Robert Downey Jr. a pass on the professor character only because, I mean, because
he reminds me of professors.
It's funny. It's funny. And also he played a much more a low-key version of a gay guy in Wonder Boys years ago. And so he can do the other version.
He's done his due, so he can fop it up in this one. I will say, we should talk about the scene where it's all the Robert Downey Jr.'s at dinner together with the captain.
Look at him guzzling. Hammer's getting hammered over here. Take it easy, buddy. Despite my best judgment, I like this kid. He's plucky. Are you plucky, kid?
Oh, he is wildly plucky.
As a, you know, a nutty professor lover, that was just so, that was so thrilling to see.
Finally, his Norbit moment coming after the Oscars.
And that was Eddie Murphy's problem. He should have waited until he had won for Dreamgirls and then done Norbit.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely a tricky tonal line to walk. And I think that the show is largely pulling it off, at least in these first episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's kind of a shade of like Catch-22, like war is absurd. We can't pretend as though it's not. We might as well lean into it. And yeah, it's got in the supporting cast, we should also bring up Sandra Oh, who I think is so great in like the brief moments that we've seen her so far. I hope she has more to do as the show goes on.
So good. And she, this is completely besides the point, but she really just looks just the exact same as she did in 2004.
I know.
It's really sort of crazy. It's like no time has passed with her. It's so, it's really incredible.
I'm like, I need to know what her hair products are, but I know that if I tried, it would never work.
And her character, on a more serious note, I think her character is so important just because, I mean, so much of the show is about identity and feeling split between, you know, different worlds and whatnot, and having her, Miss Maury, be Asian and be like, I have no, like, I'm working for this professor who's obsessed with, you know, Asian American studies, and like I have no connection with that. I'm Californian. I'm American.
Yeah.
I think it throws in a really interesting perspective and definitely challenges the captain in both like a fun flirty way from their chemistry, but also on a psychological way that I think is just interesting. Adds another layer onto
And she's specifically of Japanese heritage, and this is 1975, and so
World War II is
internment
not so far.
Was only 30 something, so she would have been alive during internment, and then here comes this younger man from a different American war in Asia. I mean, that sad and troubled history of the 20th century where America was for decades at war with Asian nations, and we have now shifted that a bit further west into the Middle East, and, you know, making a sort of sad point about the legacy of that. But within all of that sort of broader history, here are just two individuals, one of whom who is still, who is very much in the struggle, and one of them who is just sort of, she's American. She's just, it's in her past, it's in her family's past, but like she doesn't own it and yet is inevitably associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, chooses to work in the Asian American Studies department too.
With like, this fetishist professor. Maybe she doesn't have a choice, but she's invested in aspects of that identity. And I think juxtaposing someone who is, she's not assimilated. She just is American with this person who is supposed to be assimilating but actually is working undercover to not assimilate into whatever. I like that tension, and it is somehow sexy.
Maybe not the squid scene. I don't know. I don't want to.
Well, yeah.
I don't want to yuck anyone's yum.
Right. You don't want the squid fucker?
I mean, Park Chan-wook really has a thing. Have you, you know, The Handmaiden the octopus stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, so I don't know what's
going on. The squid does come directly from the book.
Okay. Right. But maybe that's what drew Park Chan-wook to it. I don't know. No, I'm kidding.
He like was Tarantino like, someone's gonna fuck a fish in this.
If it's the last thing I do. I do think we should definitely mention some of the other supporting performances, just because the general is so, so great and so fantastic. And I just the general, but also the major is so sweet and so fantastic. And when he gets, when
naming his little baby spinach and broccoli.
Spinach and broccoli.
So that they'll be strong.
And the actor, Fonsine, is so... brings a lot of sort of heart to the point where it sort of reminded me of The Sopranos when you know someone's going to get offed and you're like, you know, one of the cronies and whatnot, and then you fall for him and then boom, he's
but there's
gone.
Something a little pathetic about them at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like it's this weird mix because you are innately sort of siding with the anti-hero protagonist to achieve their goal. And so you have to sort of dehumanize them a little bit.
Do.
But then the show pushes back on that and is like, well, no, he's sweet.
He's got
sort of,
spinach and broccoli. Yeah, and he's believing in the American dream, like
his mom is right there.
His mom is there. And his side business isn't so nefarious, you know?
It's candy.
Yeah, so it's just like I think that leads me to a question of like, this is obviously about a big moral ambivalence, and I don't think that we are supposed to love or hate the captain. I think it's somewhere in between. But it's just interesting to see how that sustains across a season, because even I got sick of like sort of the Don Draper, Tony Soprano, like love-hate kind of thing. And this is a much shorter run of episodes, obviously. Yeah. But it's a tricky needle to thread to have a character who is doing pretty much baseline despicable things, but also that you care for. I think that's a testament to the performance. And but I don't know. It's a tricky ask, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, it takes a confident show to try to pull it off too, to not just kind of make him either, you know, a merciless killing machine or, you know, this put upon like actually right.
He's not doing it under threat.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He's doing it out of...
Yeah, and he's clearly haunted by it. I mean, the last image that we see at the end of episode 3 is the major, you know, with his head blown off, like, confronting him. And yeah, I mean, it shows that kind of beyond the wackier touches, like, this show does have ambitions of exploring something deeper and exploring, you know, the aftermath of horrible violence and kind of whether it can be moved beyond. And that is going to be true both of the captain himself and then, you know, of the world more broadly.
Yeah. And what, when blessed with the hindsight or zoomed out, like, what does any of that violence actually mean? Was anything accomplished? Yeah.
Oh, man, you are so, I don't want to spoil anything, but that is really like the end of the book is literally just kind of that conversation.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was anything accomplished?
I actually wrote the book. I hear that's my confession.
Oh my God. Yeah. Alias, all this under an time. Alias. Yeah.
We're going to take a brief interruption to our sympathizer coverage to talk about Bravo. America's most important television network. Bravo recently opened up their vault and released a huge number of their earlier shows like NYC Prep, Shaws of Sunset, and Real Housewives of D.C., a one-season wonder. And they're all on Peacock.
How can you say you're
not a lady?
You're disgraced America.
Wow.
You embarrassed the White House.
Wow.
And the fact that you even walk around town makes me sick.
We are so excited to go back and relive some of these shows, these lost gems that have not been available to us for some time, but we need your help.
So we want to know, what were your favorite early Bravo moments? The best fights, plot twists, shows that you think should have gotten more seasons, cough, Princesses of Long Island, cough.
Gallery Girls, even.
Oh, my God. Top Chef, Just Desserts. Just kidding. Nobody wants more of that. So please send an email or a voice memo with your choices to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com.
Our Bravo extravaganza is happening next week, so please hurry and get your messages in, Andy, if you're listening.
Please, Andy, we beg of you.
You have a little family van. When do you ever bring a family van to pick up 6 people?
Still Watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, we're talking to the sympathizers Hua Shande, who plays the captain.
Hold up.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If I've learned anything from my 30 or so years on this planet, it's that therapy is so important. Everyone needs a safe space to talk about our emotions and feelings, life changes, relationship woes, hopes and fears and dreams. So thank goodness for BetterHelp. It's entirely online, and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and work with your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/stillwatching today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/stillwatching.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
It seems pretty complicated being the captain.
Yeah, you know, he's navigating a new life in America. He's negotiating his life as a double agent. He's negotiating multiple Robert Downey Jr.'s.
That's the hardest part.
And today, he has to navigate a pretty hard-hitting interview.
Yeah.
The still watching
in person,
crew.
Yes. No less.
His greatest challenge yet. Chris and I got a chance to talk to Hua Shande, the actor, about his big lead role in The Sympathizer. Please enjoy the conversation. Here we are with Hua Shande of The Sympathizer.
Hi, guys. Chris, Hillary. Yeah.
Thank you for coming. You said a minute ago that you were having trouble remembering your Australian accent. You do such a good American accent on this show.
You really do.
Thanks. It's because when I'm here, when I did the character, and just to help me stay in the accent, I just basically tried to diminish my Australian accent. And for pretty much almost a year, I just stayed in the American accent. So every time I come back here, I just naturally assume it. It's actually easier for me to talk that way because I find sometimes when I sound like this or even, you know, especially when I've been in Australia for a while, people are just like, what? And so I'm like, oh, you know, it's like water and not water.
Oh, man, so you're like a double agent in real life.
A little bit.
Split between two
I'm
worlds.
I'm not an agent. I'm just, But, it's kind of weird because every now and then people will, like, catch my accent slipping and I can see their eye twitching and I'm like, oh, I was born here. Yeah.
Well, you just fooled me about it.
Super convincing.
Yeah, it was very convincing.
Yeah, so you mentioned the long process of making the show, but maybe before we get to that, can you talk a little bit about the beginning? Had you read the novel before you became involved in the project?
Yeah, I first got this audition in January of 2022, but I actually started reading this book 2 years prior when I was doing another project. And I guess I had a lot of time in my hands and I borrowed this book from a library. And I found it simply from doing a Google search of good books to read.
Wow.
And it popped up.
That'll work.
And I had a long list of books that I was trying to get through. And I went to the library and The Sympathizer was just one of those books that I was like, huh, this looks interesting.
Does the Pulitzer Prize like hold weight in Australia? Do you like
know? Oh, of course it does. Yeah. Of course it does. I began reading it 3 chapters in and I just remembered how devastating and traumatic that was. And because I'm a slow reader, I had to return the book. So I couldn't get through to the end of it. But fast forward, January 2022, I got my first audition. I suddenly realized, wait a minute, this is a book that I started reading a couple of years ago. Mm. And then when I saw HBO and A24 and Park Chan-wook directing this and attached as Robert and Sandra, I was like, oh my God, I've got to get my hands on this book again. So I went and bought it, read it cover to cover, and went through the hoops and hurdles of auditioning for the next 9 months. Yeah.
What was that? Yeah. What was that process like? How?
Look, I submitted my tape just like I do any other tape. And I was, you know, fairly confident. I didn't think it was better than any other tape that I did. And I just sort of crossed my fingers and hoped that they liked it. But 2 weeks later, I got a call back. And then that pretty much set me on the journey of like, callbacks every month and, you know, new scenes. We want to see you do this. Can you do this? Are you going to meet this person on Zoom? And then Director Park met me on Zoom by my third or fourth callback. And then I met the other showrunner, Don, on my like fifth callback. And every time I met them, you know, it was months in between. So I'd do it and then I'd feel really good about it afterwards. And then I'd hear nothing for a month and then I'd just let go. And then I was sleepless. I'd take walks in the middle of the night. And then I had to let go of this so many times. Mm. And then just as I'd moved on with life, you know, it's like moving on from an ex, you know, they come back into
like
your life.
Crawling
and,
back.
Yeah. And they're like, no, 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 we love you. Actually, there's nothing wrong with what you did. You know, it's us. We've been taking time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then so by July, which is 7 months in, I was flown to Korea to meet Director Park in person to do a couple of scenes for him and then have dinner with him, which was bizarre. And, you know, I relished the moment and we talked about the book and, you know, character and just, you know, the project in general and things that we both liked and didn't like. It was like another second date or something. And yeah. Then I remember getting in the car that night to be driven back home and one of the producers was just like, we'll let you know if you're the right guy. And yeah. I was like, oh my God, it's still
going.
Again? Yeah, yeah, it's still going. 8 months into it, I was in LA doing the same thing and then I came back home and another month went by, complete radio silence before I got a Zoom call from Don and he let me know that I got the role.
Wow. God, that is really a journey.
It's an odyssey. I mean, I guess the role is very specific. You know, you need somebody who's Vietnamese and who can speak Vietnamese and who can
just do all these different, weird and wonderful things, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah.
They trusted me.
Something that I really loved about the captain. I mean, we think a spy, we think, you know, James Bond and whatnot. He was kind of goofy, kind of funny. He had he was very charming and sort of a different take on a spy, a double agent than I've seen before. Mm. How much did you try to make him likable or what, did you think about that?
No, that's a great question, actually, because, you know, a lot of the time, when we think of a spy and, you know, I guess just the plethora of action movies that we're exposed to, like you said, James Bond and Jason Bourne. And then, you know, you've got all those.
There's kind of these machines.
Exactly.
Swabs.
They've got guns. They run around. They blow things up. And then, you know, they're
always frowning.
Exactly. And they're, you know, they're like the strong man and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, to play this role, I actually thought it was more important to get to the heart of the character, the core of the character, what motivates him, what drives him, what his psychology was. I thought that was more interesting. So I really sort of tried to dig down into the essence of a human being living in a period where it was just tumultuous, in the middle of conflict, you know, having to fight for your family, having to walk the line between allegiances and loyalties, between your beliefs, you know. And I thought that they were the more important and more pertinent things to this character than holding a gun and lying. So, yeah, I just read so many stories and accounts of Vietnamese people during the war and, you know, it's Vietnamese people as opposed to just general historians who account the war. And so for me, when I read those stories and read, you know, Viet's book, and there were so many anecdotes of just people who were struggling and surviving, you know, civilians who were just put in the middle of this war, you know, not of their own volition, it weighed heavy on me. And I carried those stories with me in this character. And every time I thought about this character and the war and everything, I thought about those stories as opposed to trying to not be found out, trying to hide. So I guess the psychology and my emotionality and what I brought to this character was that. And if people watch that, I think it offers something different. It's a more complete human being than someone who's just playing two sides.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, when we see him actually in episode three, you know, have to do an act of violence, he's kind of he kind of can't do it. Like it's really difficult for him, which is a surprising thing to see from a spy.
Yeah. And, you know, just even little moments like that, it's just so easy to be like, you know, dispatch this person for your own survival. But, you know, someone who is a sympathizer, someone who leans into, you know, the humanity of all sides, it's really hard to just justify having to kill people in order to save others, kill somebody to save yourself. So I hope I found that nuance in that moment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The show is it's so epic. It's a sweeping show. We're in Vietnam, we're in America. Can you talk sort of about filming and all of those, you know, different locations?
Yeah.
How is that for you as an actor?
Yeah. Look, it's fun. You know, when you get to work and get to travel, you don't complain. But look, I mean, obviously we substituted Vietnam for Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the way you say it? Thailand for Vietnam? Vietnam? You know
what I'm saying. Yeah, we got
instead of filming
in Vietnam. Filmed in Thailand, obviously, because this book it's just so controversial. It's very critical and it's very poignant on the ideologies of communism, I guess. But, you know, it's not even a book that's pointed at communism. It points at all sorts of social...
Yeah, it doesn't go easy on capitalism.
Yeah, no, it definitely
does not. Exactly. Yeah, capitalism and imperialism in general either. But anyway, so we couldn't film there, but, you know, filming in Thailand was a great substitute. And, you know, the Thai crew and the set design and the locations all made up very good replications for the time period. And so when we were there, it just actually felt like we were back in 70s, 75 Saigon, filming on all these sets. We didn't have to try really hard to feel like we were there.
Yeah. One of the first frames, it flips Hillary and I, our American understanding of the war, right? Where it's like we call it the Vietnam War, and in Vietnam they call it the American War. And it was so interesting to see this other perspective that we don't really get in our media footage, movies about
I think about like Forrest Gump, where like he goes to Vietnam and you never see a Vietnamese person, you never see who he's fighting. Like it's either
Apocalypse Now,
either invisible or they're just there to get murdered, or it's like Miss Saigon, where it's like this tragic like figure. There's really kind of no more nuanced. I mean, is that how you sort of felt about the material too? That this is kind of a perspective?
I guess, you know, the depiction of the Vietnam War, and Chris, like when you brought that up, it's so interesting, you know, and that's something that I guess I even learned recently, you know, like if to the Vietnamese people, it's obviously not the Vietnam War, it's their country. It's a war that was perpetuated by others.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess in that time of period, it was the Americans. So it's the American war for the Vietnamese people. And a lot of the time when we see the Vietnam War being depicted back to us from a Western perspective, because obviously we live in an English-speaking society, you know, Australia, America, all around the world. It's you know, look, it's not surprising that we usually see the American GI in the jungles and all of their trauma and their stories and the devastation of having to fight a conflict in that way. And, you know, obviously there's nothing wrong with that. It's just human to feel these things, to have to go through these things. I love Forrest Gump, by the way. And so when I watch that stuff, I feel for it. But that's the thing that you were saying, Hillary, like a lot of the times we don't see the Vietnamese people who actually had to suffer during this time period as well. And they suffered as much, if not more, because it was their country being blown apart. And so a lot of these stories that I read, just it made me feel like for a long time, these stories were insignificant, that they weren't worthy of telling, that they, for some reason, weren't as important to be told. Mm. And so having a cast of Vietnamese people telling these stories at the forefront of this, of the sympathizer, just allows for a different perspective that allows for a three-dimensional set of characters to tell stories that are just as, you know, funny and hilarious, as well as devastating and as traumatic as the experiences of the soldiers that were fighting this war.
The show takes such wild swings between, you know, the fall of Saigon, which is so devastating. And then, you know, you and Sandra Oh, like laughing about the time that the
squid.
Captain
well,
the squid of it all.
I will say,
it make me laugh.
I read the book and I was like, this squid scene is not going to be in the show. And you know what?
I wonder how much squid sales or calamari will go up after that episode.
Can I look at that? Look at that.
Yeah, someone
that.
Needs to track that.
Were you relieved that it was the younger version of the captain that had to deal with the squid that you didn't?
I was glad. I mean, I knew that was coming up in filming, but I was like, I was always glad that I wouldn't have to do that. But I felt terrible for the kid who had to do that. But I'm sure, you know, Looking on the positive side, his scene will be talked about, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Yeah. Oh, but your chemistry with Sandra Oh is so great, and it's so fun. It's flirty. Thanks. And what was it like working with her and, you know, developing that?
I met Sandra just before shooting in one of the rehearsals, and she's such a warm, eccentric, bubbly personality that it's so you can't help but just be attracted to her. Yeah. You know what I mean? You can't help but just be drawn to her. So to be honest, like, falling in love with Sandra Oh was really not that hard. Like, like, it's really not that hard. And to be honest, I mean, I was like, no, I'm the captain falling in love with Miss Maury. I'm not, you know, falling in love with Sandra Oh. And it's funny, there was a couple of times on set where I remember Director Park and Don McKellar, the other showrunner, would have to come up to me and be like, "Just remember the captain, you know. You know, he's a strong man, and he has to hide a lot of his own. You know, he has to hide a lot of himself." And I was like, "Yes, of course." Sorry, the fanboy in me is coming out, and I need to check that. Yeah,
it's very understandable.
Yeah, our colleague David Canfield talked to Sandra for our other podcast, Little Gold Men, and she said a few things about how she kind of took a mentorship role with you on the set. Can you say anything about that?
When you're green as I was, and this is my first production, and, you know, you're still trying to work out the machine and the rules and everything like that. A lot of the times I didn't know what I could do, what I could say, what I was allowed. And so I guess Sandra saw that in me, and she would just speak up and stand up on my behalf a lot of the times when she sort of intuitively saw that I wasn't sure.
Wow.
So when you were like needed another take on something, or if you needed a break,
A break, or even just like, you know, there was sometimes my schedule was just so inundated with just stuff, scenes, and you know, it was cutting into even just lunch, or there was stuff that I was doing during the day in terms of filming, and then afterwards they needed me to just do some recordings for next week's lot of scenes because they were starting to cut things up and they needed my voiceovers. Because obviously I narrate a portion of this show. And then it was just like my plate was just getting full, and I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And me being sort of like the actor that always wants to say yes, and I said yes to everything, I think Sandra intuitively saw that and was just like, no, these are the boundaries, and I'll speak up on your behalf and say that these are the things you can do for now and these are the things you can't. And it's not like, you know, production was people were forcing me to do anything that I didn't want to do. It's just more that the machine of filmmaking rolls along, and sometimes you forget that there are things that are humanly capable and not humanly capable.
Totally.
And being me, I'm just like, yes. I won't sleep till the weekend. I'll do it all.
That, I mean, it's got to be a lot of pressure. If your first production, which I never would have known, you're so wonderful and you have such a great performance, but, you know, you're in almost every scene. You're like probably number one on the call sheet, right? Yeah. That's a lot of responsibility for a first time.
That's it. Like being a number one and then being number one on the call sheet, I guess I'm so used to just doing roles, you know, supporting roles and guest roles. And so there's just a slightly more responsibility and a little bit more things to learn, a bit more of a learning curve that I wasn't aware of. Yeah.
Well, yeah, after 9 months, hopefully that feels less less true at the end.
I would love to do this again, season two. Yeah. I'm joking. I'm not, though. But
Well, there's a sequel to the book. It's possible.
There is. But, you know, I would love to do it again with the cast and the crew and the creators involved in this because, we felt like we told like a really special story, but it was just a really special family that made this as well.
And I feel like we've done a disservice because we've gotten this long. We haven't talked about Robert Downey Jr.
I know, we've got to bring up, which is sort of Robert Downey Jr. playing many different, you know, insidious white men. Yeah, and nefarious white men.
I'm white, so I can say evil.
We'll let Hillary say that.
Yeah. I'll frame it this way. No, like Robert, you know, obviously plays multiple characters in this show, but he plays essentially the representations of the American establishments of you know, of American society. He plays the professor, which essentially represents the cultural or educational institutions of America. And then you've got Claude, who's probably the most prominent character of Robert's characters in this show, and he represents the militaristic slash CIA. The congressman, who represents the political arm of America, and then you've got obviously the author, who's introduced at the very end of episode three, who, you know, essentially represents the media, Hollywood. And so he represents all of those arms of the American society and their effect on the Vietnamese immigrant diaspora and how their policies, how their outlook, how their teachings even affects the people who came to America essentially seeking safety and survival and were not really afforded that opportunity.
Yeah, affects the people themselves and also how they're perceived by the rest of America, which is in this very specific, very siloed way.
Yeah. And coming back to you at the very end of episode three and how the all four of Robert's characters are in the one room. And, you know, in a metaphorical way, it's almost like the all the different arms and all the different establishments. What's the word?
Like pulling him apart. They're pulling the captain in all these different ways, and they're all trying to manipulate him.
Right.
It seems.
Conspiring.
You know. Conspiring.
Yeah. Conspiring to. Yeah.
You should be a writer. That's a perfect word.
I'm just thinking of these words at the top of my head.
Yeah. It's like a Mephistophelian attempt to get him like on their side.
Right.
And while insulting him terribly in the process.
Exactly. But, you know, and.
To get him to be complicit in like the way that they have made people perceived by the rest of, you know, the nation and the world.
Right. Which serves them.
But look, I mean, shooting the actual scene was that was like probably one of the most memorable times of shooting this because it's so funny because Robert has like, you know, like Robert has like a million different characters coming out of him at once. You know, we could only capture four. But yeah, I just remember that day, you know, I think he was Claude first, but and then you had the body doubles, and then you had the first AD read out the other lines, and then Robert was doing Claude's portion of the scene.
I have in my mind him like being Mrs. Doubtfire and like frantically changing off camera, and then running back in. It was essentially
like that. But I mean, it wasn't a quick change because all of those prosthetics and makeup and costumes take hours to get into. So in between takes, you know, we were just obviously trying to figure out the next setup. And it's funny because, like, I was trying to imagine what each of the other characters that Robert would play would react like when I do my lines and stuff like that. But then Robert steps into the shoes of these characters and completely blows it out of the water. And then we had to, like, just do some retakes and stuff because, like, the reactions that I had that I thought he would do was just completely not going to match. And you're just like, you know, I'm trying to keep up with his characters and he's trying to obviously do his, and it was funny just watching his brain work. He was trying to remember, hang on, where am I in this part of the story with this part of the character? Am I, you know, and it's just like,
That's so much to juggle. Yeah.
How long did it take to film that scene?
That scene actually took 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah, it took 3 days just because, you know, the different setups that we had, him changing in and out, me refilming reactions because, you know, I'm trying to anticipate what he would do. And then when he would do it, it was just like, wow, I did not even expect you would do that.
Surprising actor. Yeah. What was he like? Does he have as many characters off screen as he does on screen? What was it like? What's he like to work with?
See, the thing with Robert is that I first met Robert on the fourth day of filming and, you know, I was so anxious and nervous because, you know, you're working with an Oscar winner right now.
Although he wasn't back then,
but you know, when you're working
has he changed since the Oscar?
You know, we'll see if I get to work with him, we'll see. But yeah, like, you know, when you're working with such a high caliber actor and, you know, there's very experienced people on set and, you know, I just remember when he first walked on set on that fourth day, you know, you hear on the radios, Robert's walking on set, you know, everyone's getting ready to do their thing. And then Robert was by himself and he was already in his prosthetics and makeup and he was Claude. And this is in episode three, when he walks up with his...
Oh, with the little dog?
With the little dog after Sandra drives
away. That's your first scene together.
Yeah, that was my first filming day with Sandra and Robert.
That's a big day.
Yeah, yeah. And then he walks up with his dog and, you know, in his costume and everything. And I first thought, oh, wait, is that Robert or is that his body double? And yeah, yeah. And then he comes on, you know, and he puts his hand on my shoulder and is like, you know, it's me. Hey, it's Robert. You know, how are you? Everything like that. And then he just put his hand on my shoulder and was just like, you know, brother, you know, like, don't worry about it. You know, we're going to screw this up together. Basically, like, he just relaxed me and he just, I guess he set the tone of looking forward that, you know, we were just going to spend the next 9 months just having fun, mucking around, playing with scenes and not taking things too seriously, because the show's so serious that you can't just sit in that. You've got to really have fun. And he was such a wonderful, generous actor to work with.
Is that spirit of play kind of something that Director Park also brought?
Yeah. Director Park, you know, he's a man of few words. He doesn't, you know, say and do too much, but you can see that cheeky little glint in his eye and that smirk from the corner of his mouth every time he knows he's going to do something really hilarious in a scene. But Director Park is very specific, is very detail-oriented. So, you know, he sort of throws these darts on the board for you and it's your job to connect them. And it took me a while to learn that because, you know, I was just trying to do my best and then you're getting all these notes coming in left, right, and center. And then I was kind of like, oh, my God, they're going to fire me. For a good month, I was like, oh, my God, I can't do this. They're going to fire me. But no, Director Park is very supportive and I think he inspires confidence because he's so confident in his choices. He knows exactly what he wants, how to tell the story within the frame so visually. And he tells you exactly what he needs from you and he lets you do the job. And once you figure that out and you're sort of dancing with him, it was a breeze.
Yeah. Well, thank God he didn't fire you.
Well, they couldn't fire you. It took 9 months.
Yeah, yeah, that's, no, yeah. That's, I mean, a part of me was just like, guys, please. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for...
Great. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, more on The Sympathizer and HBO's love of limited series.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so this is, you know, actually, this is, I was going to say the second limited series from HBO this year that we have done, but it's actually the third.
Actually.
Yeah, because True Detective, Night Country is kind of its own thing. And then we did The Regime, and now we're talking about The Sympathizer. I feel like the limited series is one of those formats that can really go either way, but it does really tend to draw stars. They tend to be splashy. They tend to be bigger budget, you know, at least now in the current like TV landscape. How do we feel about the limited series that we've surveyed this year? Do we want more of them? I feel like I keep talking to people about how I miss serialized television.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Do you guys feel that way too? Or
I like a miniseries, but I think people maybe take the art form for granted where it's like, well, we'll just do a miniseries. It's like, but that's a particular kind of storytelling.
It's not just a short TV show.
No,
it's not just a long
movie.
Exactly.
When you're adapting a novel like The Sympathizer, which from what I've seen, very sprawling, dense with ideas and characters, it's a natural fit to do that kind of thing. There's other stuff on other networks. You know, I just reviewed Under the Bridge on Hulu, which I think has its merits based on a true crime miniseries that, like, doesn't need to be 8 hours. Like, it's a big story about a really sad thing that happened, but, like, you can feel the show really straining to fill that time. And so I think on HBO, when you're adapting something, that works. Or if you're Mike White, or if you're, you know, I forget his name, but the guy who did Mayor of Easttown, like, great. I think it, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a wishy-washy answer, but it works when it works. Mm-hmm. And I wish people would approach the format a little more reverently and thoughtfully.
Yeah, well, and I think it comes back to the point that Hillary made that we're getting bigger and bigger stars. It's like you're not going to nail down Kate Winslet for six seasons of a show. And not that the
Glenn Close did Damages for like 100 years, I want to say.
Different time.
Different time. But it does feel like it's motivated more recently by a big name, you know, an incredible person, you know, a star, being like, oh, I want to do this thing. And it probably isn't a movie, but there's no way that I'm going to do this for more than 6 months or however long. Let's just make it a miniseries. And I don't think that always works.
Right. And then they cheat and do a second season.
Yeah. If it's good. If they want.
Big Little Lies being like the, you know, that is.
They're trying to do a third.
Not to be, you know, hyperbolic, but like that first season of Big Little Lies is like pretty much perfectly entertaining. I mean, it's perfect entertainment.
Like
it's
right
so,
then.
So well acted. It ends perfectly. It, you know, obviously there are some bobbles along the way. And then the second season, I think, tarnished the legacy of the first season.
Yeah.
And there were whispers about there being a Mayor of Easttown season two, I was like, no.
Don't do it.
And it doesn't seem like that's happening, thank God. But and White Lotus is sort of in the middle ground there because there is a recurring character in the two seasons. And...
Well, but everything that you're talking about, though, they're all mysteries. Like, mysteries have a natural endpoint. And I think that the problem with so many of these shows is that they reach that endpoint and people liked the show. And so they have to kind of tie themselves in knots to find a way to come back. And there's never going
to
be as good of a whodunit in the second time around. I mean, I feel like what I'm really missing is a long-term serial drama, because I just don't feel like we get so many of those anymore.
Law
like,
and Order SVU?
There's procedurals on network
procedurals,
TV.
Yeah.
HBO doesn't really, like, we haven't had, like, the new Alan Ball series.
There's industry, I guess.
There was Succession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that was only four seasons, you know.
Even that, you know, Game of Thrones was... six seasons, seven seasons? I can't even remember now.
Seven seasons,
Sounds right.
No, it was longer than that. It was like seven or eight. But it was years, right? It was like 10 years in the making between things.
Yeah.
And yeah, just a something that lets you really kind of dig into characters, dig into relationships, not just be about events, but be about the like personalities involved, and allow you to really kind of form attachments to characters. Like there just are so few opportunities to do that on TV now. I don't know if it's just that streaming fractures attention spans, but the thing is that people want to stream shows that last a long time as like
but
streamers
running out of old ones.
Exactly. So that's why we got to make some new ones.
I mean, speaking of running out of resources, like in a couple years' time, what posts are we going to write ranking seasons of things? You know,
we've done Sex in the City, we've done the bloggers.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, we've run out of things. Have we run out of things to say about Sex in the City?
Well, never.
Don't get us started.
But I also think that part connected to that is discrete episodes. You know, not every series. Succession, you can say, oh, I like the episode where X happens, but otherwise things kind of blur. I mean, obviously Logan's death, sure. But like,
that stands out so well because it's a great hour of television
it's discrete. Yeah. But like, with a lot of serialized drama now, but really with miniseries, it's like there's not a single hour to point to. It's more just sort of a big one thing just chopped up into bits. And luckily, The Sympathizer thus far feels more episodic.
Yes, it
you know,
does
episodes
feel
distinct. So that's a help. But again, it's something that should be really carefully approached, and sometimes it feels watching limited series that someone wrote a really long script and then arbitrarily was like, and that's the end of episode one, and you know, and that's not the way to do it.
No, I mean, you're right. There is an art to it. I mean, I think that Ripley pulled off the miniseries very well also.
I was going to say
Ripley, I think, stands out in that regard. But then again, you have the binge model of Netflix, which it does all sort of blur together to some degree. I was actually going to say something that I think really does the limited series really well, re-Netflix, is Baby Reindeer, which we haven't talked about.
Oh.
It feels like a story that was told in the right amount of time. We have some good episodic moments. The Edinburgh Fringe Festival episode was really fantastic and really sort of standalone there. And it's funny because it feels like I've created this argument in my head that we need to go back to, you know, discrete episodes of television over week to week and bring back that model. And then watching Baby Reindeer, I was like, well, actually, I think they're done. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this new model does work.
As long as they're made well. Yeah, the miniseries is a perfectly viable format that has its own demands. And I think all we're saying is that if it should be a miniseries, then it will work as one. And if it's being stretched or if it's being compressed, then yeah. I wish that you had told the story in a different way.
It's the Robert Downey Jr. If it's good, we'll let it fly.
Are you hoping for Shogun season two? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, that, yes, honestly. Yeah.
Well, that's also a really good show.
I mean, I think I'm not the only one who's hoping for Shogun season two. But yeah, like, that is a show that deserves to be on for like 10 years. There's so much happening. There's so many people. There's so many factions. And yeah, having it all laid out for you and then it's over. Like, yeah, it's what a tease.
Maybe it, because it's been a hit, maybe they will, FX will do more of it. Maybe now the miniseries for some properties is just the audition.
It's a pilot.
It's the audition. It's an 8-hour pilot.
Yeah.
Which is like...
which is messed up in its own way.
Let's not encourage that, but if it works out, it works out.
If only because of category fraud at the Emmys, which is a real problem.
Well, that's a whole other episode of this podcast. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. We will be back next week talking about all of our favorite vintage Bravo shows and moments. And again, we need your help. We want to hear your thoughts on your favorite vintage Bravo moments. So please send us voice memos or emails to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. This is all inspired, of course, by Bravo opening up the Bravo vault and releasing some of their early shows onto Peacock. What are those earlier shows? Well, you can revisit The Horror of NYC Prep, which I recently did. You can read about that on our website. There's the what I call Brad Goreski Origins, which is
the Rachel Zoe project. Of course. It's banana.
Yeah. There's a whole host of things. Tabitha Takes Over, Tabitha Salon Take Over. Sadly, no Gallery Girls, but maybe...
we can still talk about
it. But if this Still Watching episode is a big
enough
hit...
maybe if we are annoying enough...
we will get it back.
Be the change we wish to see. So if you have a story or a connection to any of these shows, if you're listening, Chantal from Gallery Girls, please... reach out to us, send us an email or a voice memo to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, or just come say hi on Twitter/X. You can find me at Hillabuster with two R's.
And you can find me at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Chris Triss, and my DMs are open to discuss anything about Bravo. Please send things to us.
And I was, in fact, asking Brad Goreski to DM me. Anyway, this has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered by James Yost and mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday with our peek into the Bravo Vault. Looking forward to seeing you then.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.